Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with growing tensions in the standoff between Qatar and its neighbours, led by Saudi Arabia, who issued an unrealistically harsh and humiliating set of demands to the tiny Gulf state under an ultimatum that has since passed. And now they are dismissing Qatar's response to their list of demands as the crisis deepens. Marwan Khedi, the Anthony Shadid Chair of Global Media, Politics and Culture and Director for Advanced Research in Global Communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us. An expert on the Arab media, we will discuss how much Egypt's and Saudi Arabia's demand to shut down Qatar-based Al Jazeera is at the heart of this dispute, provoked by Saudi Arabia's belligerent young crown prince, who appears to have bitten off more than he can chew in Yemen and is now threatening war, or at least regime change, in Qatar. Then we'll assess the extent to which Donald Trump's visit to Poland is based on his aversion to protests, which are being planned in Hamburg and London, and his susceptibility to enticements by the authoritarian right-wing Polish leader, whose law and justice government will bus in adoring fans of Trump from the countryside to what they have promised the White House will be, quote, a great patriotic picnic. A former senior advisor with the State Department's policy planning staff, Charles Gatti, a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, joins us to look into what seems more like a mutually beneficial photo op than a diplomatic engagement, particularly since Trump has refused to meet with anyone from Poland's opposition. Then finally, we'll examine the looming crisis following North Korea's long-range missile test, which has essentially called Trump's bluff since he had warned that a test of a North Korean missile that could reach the U.S., quote, is not going to happen. Now that it has happened, we will speak with a former State Department senior analyst, Stephen Norper, senior director of the Korea Society and associate of the Weatherhead Institute and Pacific Forum, and a professor at Columbia University. He joins us to discuss this crisis that, in the absence of diplomacy, could lead to devastating military consequences and civilian casualties. And joining us now is Marwan Khedi, who's the Anthony Shadid Chair in Global Media, Politics and Culture, and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. And his latest book is The Naked Blogger of Cairo, now out in paperback. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Khedi.
Glad to be with you.
Well, thanks, Marwan. And my sense is that this standoff over Qatar and its neighbors, led by Saudi Arabia and Egypt, obviously they started out with very harsh and unrealistic demands. And then the deadline passed and nothing happened. So in effect, Qatar called the young Saudi crown prince's bluff. And now they're all saying that the reply to these demands is insufficient. So where is this heading? It's certainly not getting any better.
It is not getting any better. Officially, we are in a situation where Kuwait, who is mediating the crisis, because Kuwait and Oman are relatively neutral in this, has officially obtained a two-day extension of the deadline. And the Saudis, the UAE, and Egypt said they will continue the blockade. They will escalate if they need to. So where it's heading, we don't know. But we know what we do know is that there's a sort of two broad coalitions emerging. On the one hand, you have, of course, the Saudis leading the charge with the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain, and a few other countries. On the other hand, we have Qatar, which is being supported by Turkey and Iran. Without the Iranian and Turkish support, Qatar would have had to cave, mainly because it's landlocked. Its only land border is with Saudi Arabia. They have food insecurity issues. Commerce will grind to a halt. So the Turks and the Iranians are basically what is allowing Qatar to keep staring down the Saudis.
Well, the Saudi initiative, if that's the right word to put it, is led by clearly by MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who's responsible for getting Saudi Arabia into Yemen, where they're bogged down and going nowhere. He seems impetuous and impulsive. There's also a crisis, I believe, within the Saudi royal family itself, with the essentially ousted Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. He's now, I believe, under house arrest. So let's start with internal Saudi politics. Is this the boy king just out of his depth?
Well, you know, this is, I mean, there's a broader context to this, which is sort of a more aggressive Saudi foreign policy that really had to do with the Iranian nuclear deal. The Saudis did feel betrayed by the U.S., and the elevation of the deputy crown prince to crown prince is something that a lot of people have seen, have been talking about, that it's going to happen, but it happened a little too quickly. What we have basically is a situation where there are all kinds of stories and rumors about the dispute within the royal family. It does look, however, so first of all, we need to say that the Saudi court denied that Prince bin Nayef is under house arrest. But clearly there was a power struggle, and it seemed that, at least for the time being, it is settled in favor of the new crown prince. The new crown prince is responsible for defense policy. He's obviously in charge of foreign policy. And he's much, much more aggressive than his predecessors. So there's the engagement in Yemen. There's the new friendship with Mr. Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of President Trump. So it seems that there are obviously two camps within the royal family in Saudi Arabia, but the new crown prince does seem to be in charge. What is also befuddling is the sort of contradictory statements coming out from Washington. Right. If you follow, I mean, it's not a coincidence that this happened very soon after Mr. Trump visited Saudi Arabia, and obviously it was a fest. If you read the Saudi media, if you follow the Saudi media, they're saying this is the kind of U.S. president we need. They're very resentful at Barack Obama for not having supported the Saudi camp as fully as they wanted to. So there's a sort of a global political situation that is intersecting with a regional geopolitical situation that is leading to all of this.
Well, Marwan, I think you put it politely. I mean, Donald Trump himself more or less crowed about Saudi Arabia following his playbook and going after Qatar. And then on the other hand, you got Rex Tillerson tearing his hair out trying to solve the problem.
Indeed. And Mr. Trump even bragged on Twitter that he's behind, that it was his idea. And a lot of commentators pointed out immediately, he seemed to be unaware when he posted that tweet that the U.S. has a massive military base in Qatar, that there are all kinds of issues that did not enter into the equation before he sent that tweet. But we're still seeing contradictory statements from the U.S. I think the U.S. now is in a wait-and-see period to see what's going on. And evidently, it's, you know, you sort of fuel a fire and then you watch it burn. I think it's a very dangerous situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Marwan Krady, the Anthony Shadid Chair in Global Media, Politics and Culture and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. And his latest book is The Naked Blogger of Cairo, now out in paperback. But my sense, Marwan, is that the real agenda here, and this is a part of the demands, of course, these 13-point demands that were made, which are unrealistic and humiliating, and they basically, the Saudis and the Egyptians, General Sisi, they just want to shut down Al Jazeera. It's been driving them crazy for a long time. And on top of that, I think there's an element of spite here. I think these authoritarian leaders like Sisi and the Al Saud family basically want to say to the Arab street, you know, you had your fun with the Arab Spring, but it's over, and just deal with reality now. What's your sense?
Indeed. I mean, you know, this is the interesting thing about Algeria. So we had a couple of recent statements, one from the Saudi foreign minister, who's saying we're doing all of this not to harm Qatar, but we're doing all of this to help Qatar, right? So there's as if they're trying to force a wedge between the Qatari rulers and the people of Qatar, or Qatar as a nation. On the other hand, we have the Qatari foreign minister who said that this is nothing short of an attempt to strip sovereignty out of Qatar. And so clearly there's a very big agenda. The interesting thing about Al Jazeera is that in effect, Al Jazeera today is not the kind of threat that it used to be to the Saudis, even to the Egyptians, that it used to be, you know, whether in the late 90s, mid-2000s with Saudi Arabia, when we had Saudi dissidents on the air, live talk shows from Doha, attacking the royal family, or during the Egyptian revolution, that was part of the Arab uprisings, where Al Jazeera came out very clearly and unequivocally in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood against the Egyptian military. If you recall, when Mr. Morsi was elected, Qatar gave a $1 billion loan to Egypt. There was another billion that was supposed to materialize that never happened. And so I think what's interesting is Al Jazeera, there's definitely an element of spite. I think you put your finger on a fundamental dimension of all of this, that Al Jazeera is no longer an effective threat, but symbolically it looms very large, particularly because, you know, there was research years ago that showed that a lot of people thought that Al Jazeera and Qatar were interchangeable. So the sort of brand of Al Jazeera nearly overshadowed the brand of the country. So shutting down Al Jazeera is, in effect, taking over Qatar. So we have to understand the symbolic dimensions of this, which are, I think, much more important than the actual effective strategic threat that Al Jazeera poses to the Saudi royal family or to the current military dictatorship in Egypt.
Well, already it just seems that the logic is most of what they've said to justify this have been pretty absurd. I don't think the charges of terrorism are particularly, you know, I mean, obviously they've supported Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, and of course Hamas being a protege of the Muslim Brotherhood, and maybe that's why Israel wants them curtailed as well. But the idea that they're somehow in bed with Iran is absurd, and in fact, Saudi Arabians are driving Qatar into the embrace of Iran, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, when you're faced with these kinds of threats, it's no longer a political choice. It's a choice for survival. And so the fact that the Iranians and the Turks are helping Qatar right now is truly a lifeline, whether with Turkish military troops coming into Qatar. According to the Turks and the Qatari, this was agreed upon previously, before the crisis, or Iranian food shipments to Qatar. You're definitely throwing Qatar more in the arms, in the embrace of these two big regional powers. And I think in many ways, Qatar will be emerging more and more clearly as a proxy space where you have Iran and Turkey, with all their disagreements, they are more or less united on this, on one hand, and on the other hand, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So you have the four largest, most strategically important countries in the region, in addition to Israel, that are using Qatar as a proxy space to settle their scores.
Well, clearly there is a irony here in terms of who supports terrorism and who doesn't. There's quite a controversy going on now in the UK. As you know, there was a report on who funds extremism and influences extremism in the UK that followed the recent terrorist attacks, and Theresa May, under her watch as Home Secretary, this report was commissioned and then it's been held up, and now the Henry Jackson Society in the UK has issued a report saying that Saudi Arabia is the chief foreign promoter of Islamic extremism in the United Kingdom. And that's making life difficult for Theresa May. So in terms of this idea of who funds terrorism, it is pretty extraordinary that the extent to which the Trump administration seems to be totally turned a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's previous role, whether it's doing it now or not. You said that the Jared's forged relationship with MBS, I believe Ivanka Trump's already received $100 million for her charity. So what's going on here in terms of Muslim ban, this selectivity in terms of this tiny little Gulf nation of Qatar being blamed for terrorism when there's so much evidence that Saudi Arabia's been sponsoring it for the longest time?
Indeed. I mean, so this is a situation we have. If you look at the countries involved, the Qataris, but also the Saudis, the Turks, the Iranians, have all at different times sponsored groups, as governments, but also as individuals through donations. Because don't forget, these are countries that have a lot of very wealthy individuals whose sympathies lay with various strands of political Islamism, whether violent or not, and whether, you know, how violent and all such things. So, you know, this is where the Syrian theater becomes very important, because at various points, the Qataris and the Saudis supported various Islamist camps within the Syrian war, within the Syrian crisis. And so, obviously, to accuse Qatar alone of funding this or that group is definitely ironic. But you have to understand also that, you know, this is a very sort of rhetorical strategies that are unfolding, in the sense that different countries supporting different Islamist groups are accusing each other of terrorism, partly for domestic consumption, but also, very importantly, for consumption in Western public opinion. Because as you know, you mentioned the UK, but also in the US, political Islamism has become sort of a ballyhoo, has become sort of the big other. So invoking it in these terms allows people to score political points that find echo in London, in Washington, in Paris, not to mention Moscow, as opposed to just regionally.
Well, Maran Kredi, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show again.
And again, I've been speaking with Maran Kredi, who's the Anthony Shadid Chair in Global Media, Politics and Culture, and the Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. And his latest book is The Naked Blogger of Cairo, now out in paperback. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Poland's authoritarian leader has lured Donald Trump to Poland for a photo op.